welcome back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Paul's typing away furiously there.
Yeah, I'm actually just writing something about Alan Hubbard. Mate, so the thing with Michael Stastny, getting back to it, because we were covering this before, right? The thing with this whole quarter meter thing is that what I was trying to say to people is this. Understand this, New Zealanders. This has happened right in front of your eyes and you didn't get it, right? Bernard Hickey sparked this whole bloody thing against Alan Hubbard, against Alan Crafer, and that resulted in Corder Mentha being appointed to Crafer Farms as receiver and the sale of Crafer Farms to the Chinese. But that's not the point. The point is, somehow in that transaction, Land Corp / the government / the Crown ended up in control of this land, in control of these farms. It became the government's decision, Land Corp's decision, whether or not to sell to the Chinese. It became a government decision. Right, it was official. The OIA, the OIO, or whatever they call it, the Overseas Investment Office, or whatever, had a part to play in it all. So, all of a sudden, this was a privately owned farm where the debt was owed to the Westpac Bank, and the receiver was Michael Stiassny and Corder Mentha. All of a sudden, it becomes a sort of a quasi Crown issue where the Crown's in control of this whole situation, working with the receivers to sell these farms. On what? On behalf of Westpac Bank to the Chinese? I don't really know. How did that actually happen? It's a bit unclear, isn't it, really? But that's not the point. The point is, you've got these commonalities where Bernard Hickey stuck it to Alan Crafer. And I mean, hello, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning or 5 o'clock in the morning and driving to the South Waikato and sneaking onto this guy's farms and filming his pigs and coming back and sparking an animal welfare debate. If that isn't sticking it to somebody, what is? You know? I mean, this didn't happen by accident. He wasn't sleep driving.
Yeah, I mean, he wasn't just, you know, having uncontrollable craving for a fresh bacon sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, you know, he wasn't possessed by aliens at the time, or, you know, something didn't step into his body and make him do it unconsciously. I mean,
we can't confirm or deny that.
Well, yeah, exactly. I mean, if you listen to the way it carries on TV, you'd have to wonder. But, I mean, I think economics is only useful as a form of employment for economists, quite frankly. But so here's these commonalities, and then we have Corder Mentha is commissioned to write the report damning Alan Hubbard, and that report has been used ever since, right? So they initially said $300 million worth of toxic related party loans where the people, if we've got no way of knowing whether these people were paying their loans back or not, we've only got Corder Mentha's word for it and the government's word for it. We can't actually get the proof anymore, right? Because no trial's ever been had, right? So none of the stuff's ever appeared in the courtroom. We've only got their word for it. Bernard Hickey assists the process by really sticking it to Alan Hubbard with his 10 reasons why Alan Hubbard should apologise to New Zealand article, right? Now, this is long before Alan Hubbard was ever even charged with a crime, right? So you've got all these heavyweight hitters like John Key and, you know, Bernard Hickey and all these guys wading into it, sticking it furiously to Alan Hubbard long before the man's ever even charged with a crime, right? And nobody is questioning the failure in process here. And on top of all of that, quietly in the background, they're all working off of Corder Mentha's report. Next minute, South Canterbury Finance goes under and all of Alan Hubbard's investments in dairy holdings get put on the block, right, by who other than the Crown. And how much are we talking about? 45,000 hectares. 45,000 hectares of prime South Island dairy farming land. So, all of these same players involved in both of these situations, and people aren't connecting the dots. What do we have? Let's cut down to the basic facts. Now, anyone who hates Alan Hubbard, hates me, hates anyone defending Alan Hubbard, loves John Key, doesn't want any of this stuff questioned, the one thing none of these people can argue with are the facts, the historical facts. What I'm saying here are not my opinion. They're facts. What are the facts? Bernard Hickey, a key protagonist against Alan Crafer and Alan Hubbard in both situations. Corder Mentha, directly involved in both situations, South Canterbury Finance and Crafer Farms. Both Alan Hubbard and Alan Crafer lost their businesses, their empires, whatever you want to call it, on the basis of accusations alone. Both cases, no court orders were used. Both cases, both men were hanged by the media, in the media, by media trials without any access to a courtroom, no opportunity to defend themselves. All these decisions were made regardless of them, right? So you have a situation where the next situation, the next fact is who became the principal, I guess, vendor of the land in both situations? The Crown. So what do we have? Two citizens of New Zealand. Let's understand this clearly. Two citizens of New Zealand have had their assets seized and sold by the Crown on the basis of accusations alone, with no court orders, no trials, right? After media, after basically, yes, they did have a trial, but it was conducted in the media, by the media. The evidence was all rhetoric. No proof has ever been provided, right? I mean, there was no context ever given for the animal welfare issue in Alan Crafer's case. It was all done on the basis of the out. It was the whole thing occurred on the back of the wave of public outrage about these pigs, right? That's the whole receivership occurred as a result of the wave of public outrage about these pigs, which again was sparked by Bernard Hickey, one of the key players in both situations. Now, you'd have to wonder who is putting Bernard Hickey up to stick it to all these people.
If you have a look at his YouTube channel, he's got 1,000 subscribers. I've got nearly 6,000 subscribers, and his average views on his videos are between 60 and 200. I've got videos that have like 40,000 and what have you. I'm not even making any money off that YouTube channel. Where the hell's his money coming from?
I personally don't understand why anybody would listen to Bernard Hickey, but, you know, that's their choice. But the thing is that these commonalities between these two issues are facts, and what I'm saying is are facts, and that is that whatever way you look at them, and you can argue about it till you're blue in the face, oh, these guys were guilty, yeah, the rest of it, doesn't change the fact that these men lost everything on the basis of accusations alone, and whatever way you look at it, the Crown became the vendor of their property, of their land, right, on the basis of accusations alone with no court orders and no trials. So even drug dealers, convicted drug dealers, got better protection than these two men did.
What other sources of alternative media or things of that nature have been waffling on about this as well? Because that was another reason why you wanted to come on. No, I'm not talking about defending them. I'm talking about attacking them.
You're the only person that's provided any vehicle by which Alan Hubbard could have got a defence. Nobody else in the mainstream has been bothered. And I'll tell you what I'm disappointed about is the actions of people like Martin Bradbury, right? What Martin Bradbury did after Alan Hubbard died, which was completely and utterly gutless after Alan was killed, was to write that article calling him Mr. Magoo. Very disrespectful, unbelievably disrespectful, actually really hurtful for the people who knew Alan, right? Calling him Mr. Magoo and calling him a fraud. I mean, it didn't take a lot of guts to do that after the guy was dead. I mean, at least the other journalists were sort of sticking it to him when he was alive, knowing full well that he wouldn't fight back. So they all got, you know, everybody was really brave, you know, really sticking it to this 83-year-old guy on dialysis, you know, hey, New Zealand, I'm your champion. I'm sticking it to this old guy for you because he's that bad that you need me to help you protect you from him. You know what I mean? I mean, what a bunch of tossers, right? But at least they did it when he was alive. He could have sued him. I used to say to him, mate, sue this guy, sue that guy. And he actually thought about it. He thought about suing Bernard Hickey. He actually came close to it. He was advised to because what Bernard did was just shocking. But at least it was done when Alan was alive. The worst aspect about what Bradbury did was that Bradbury was just a flea. That man is a flea. He waited until Alan was dead, and then he sort of sneaked out and stuck it to him, you know, and it was just pathetic. I mean, he didn't provide any facts to to support anything he said. He basically just, it was all rhetoric and spin. And I'll tell you why he did it. Listen up, New Zealanders, and you listen up, you Labour supporters, right? Labour does not want this issue gone over. Labour doesn't want this issue delved into just as much as National doesn't want it delved into. And I'll tell you the reason why. Because 62 finance companies collapsed on their watch. And they know it. And they know they can't kick up a stink about the travesty of justice involved here. They sort of danced around it a bit by asking a few questions in Parliament when they thought they might stand a chance of making John Key look bad on the procedural issues. But overall, Labour decided to leave it alone. It's all a big, hairy, scary issue because they know damn well that they could easily be criticised by a lot of people for the fact that most other finance companies collapsed on their watch with little or no regulatory oversight. Now, in my opinion, Martin Bradbury is very cunningly and cleverly trying to help Labour rewrite history by putting a spin on the situation to sort of help National in a roundabout way continue making Alan Hubbard look like he's to blame for it all, because it actually suits Labour to not have this tin of worms opened up. Because all that's going to happen is it's going to end up in a big shit fight that no one will win because John Key will just stand up in Parliament and, excuse my French, sorry,
it's going to the affiliates as well.
Yeah. It's going to end up in a fight that no one can win because they know very well that National can stand up in court in Parliament and wipe the floor with them over their failure to act on the other finance company. And that is the reason why, in my opinion, Martin Bradbury has been busily sticking it to Alan Hubbard without any evidence and without any facts. He's just continuing the spin, continuing the rhetoric, continuing to try to influence public opinion that this man was a fraud, and he's actually helping Labour in the process. David Cunliffe doesn't want this tin of worms opened up because it makes him look bad. Do you understand that? And he knows that National can wipe the floor with him because all of those finance company collapses happened on his watch and he didn't act.
Was David Cunliffe the finance minister or something like that under Labour?
His associate finance minister.
Oh, okay.
Now, you know, so nobody's in. The thing that upsets me about this is that nobody has shown any interest in the procedural issues here. And the thing that really concerns me about the future of this country and the future of our society is that the core issue that people have turned a blind eye to here is very simple. I've said it before. You, New Zealanders, every single one of you is entitled to the presumption of innocence before being proven guilty in a court of law, proper court of law, before your peers. Alan Hubbard has been denied that right. Now, you can argue about this until you're blue in the face about whether you think that man was guilty based on what John Key and everyone else has said, but that doesn't change the fact that he never had a trial. So if you are demanding that everybody accept that Alan Hubbard was guilty, regardless of the fact, then you are basically saying that in this particular case, because the amount of money is involved, we should dispense with this person's rights. And I'm saying no. If you start doing that, no matter how little or how much money is involved, you are breaking and weakening one of the fundamental cornerstones of a civil and compassionate society. You deny one other member of society that right, you deny everyone that right. If you deny one person that right, you undermine that right for everybody. That is the basis on which I defended Alan Hubbard.
I've been saying that unless we're all free, none of us are free.
Absolutely. You know, if you stand by and turn a blind eye to the stripping of one person's rights, regardless of what the reasons are, right, then you are undermining everybody's rights. And I said to you in my last interview, listen up, New Zealand. You cannot have the situation in a civil society where one person like John Key can stand up and issue an accusation and half the country believes that the person he's accusing should have their rights dispensed with because of the amount of money involved or whatever the justification is given. You cannot have that. The second you do, you allow that to happen, you're on a slippery slope where all of our rights are becoming eroded. And the only difference between Alan Hubbard and Kim.com is the fact that Kim.com has a retaliatory nature and he's prepared to stand up for himself. Alan Hubbard was so naive. Alan Hubbard was such a nice guy that he just couldn't bring himself to believe that anyone could be as evil as we were telling him they were. And he just was convinced that there was some way to resolve all of this, that if he worked quietly, if he trusted his lawyers, which he began not to do towards the end, but that he just kept agreeing with everything his lawyers said, that his lawyers would help him find a way to negotiate a peaceful resolution to this with the government. We were just tearing our hair out with Alan in the end. I think the biggest mistake that he ever made was trusting his lawyers, because in my opinion, they have fundamentally failed in their duty to care for their client, and I accuse them directly of that, and they can challenge me on it, but I'll guarantee they'll never ever drag me into a courtroom to attack me for it, because they know I can prove I'm right.
Now, I believed, as soon as I heard that Alan Hubbard had died in a car crash, I was highly suspicious of that. You know, how convenient for the government, all of a sudden this whole thing goes away.
It was an accident.
Yeah.
Ask me.
Yeah. It wasn't an accident, you reckon?
No way. Not in a million years. Not with what I know. No way without Alan. And I'll tell you why, because I know specific facts related. I knew Alan and Jean so well in the end. She still calls me, right? She still calls me and stays in touch with me long after he died. She's quite lonely now, sadly. But I even knew what they were going to be doing the day after he was killed. If anybody wants to verify this, they can go away and check if they like, as it's absolutely correct. The day after Alan Hubbard was killed, he was due to fly to Nelson with his wife at one of his daughter's request, because one of his daughters is the accountant for Helicopters New Zealand, which, if you remember, was one of the companies that he tipped into. Here's the thing. He tipped Helicopters New Zealand and Scales Corporation into South Canterbury Finance as an act of good faith to the New Zealand taxpayers after the government applied the Crown Guarantee. He was the only finance company owner in the world, to act in good faith in that manner, to put his own private assets into the company after the Crown Guarantee, the government guarantee, was applied, as an act of good faith to say to people, I'm giving you this as a gift just to show you that I'm acting in good faith. And nobody, that was never ever used in his defence in the media trial against him.
And unfortunately, we've come to break. Let's get back into this, because I called this sort of expose the Alan Hubbard conspiracy, because when two or more people come and they attack another person without people knowing why or how, that's qualified as a conspiracy, ladies and gentlemen, okay? Because somebody's benefiting. We'll be right back with Paul Carruthers.
Ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor.
Believe what you want. My evidence is greater. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. On AmericanFreedomRadio.com, and incidentally, the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. You do realize, folks, that we're on 5 days a week, right, and all of it's archived. And if you want some commercial-free archives, oh boy, do you just go and give me a donation or subscribe for as little as $1 a month, and we will get you the link to the ad-free archives page, baby. Saves you so much listening time, and it's actually really, really awesome, because the conversation just goes right up. You know, it's the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, and when it's ad-free, it's like the fastest hour and 35 minutes in talk radio. It's unbelievable. And Paul, I don't know if you'll be offended by this, but incidentally, you know, I wasn't even thinking about it. I was like, what's the first shirt or something that's off the line that I can just wear today? And it was this one. It says, I support gay marriage, so long as both chicks are hot.
Mate, let me tell you something about gay people. Gay men should not get married. They should just find someone they hate and buy them a house.
You know, cut out the middleman.
Anyway, let's not go there. Where were we?
We're talking about how Alan's car crash.
Okay, yeah. Look, I know Alan's doctor quite well, because I got to know him. He was one of Alan's investors. Lost a lot of money in it, actually, but refused to let that influence him. Look, here's the thing. People need to ask themselves this. Why do we have the situation where there were people Alan Hubbard knew personally who lost more than $1 million because of the government's actions, but who refused to allow that to influence them and who stood by him rigidly and still do to this day? Why did they do that? Why would they do that if they didn't know beyond any doubt that this man did not deserve what was done to him? Why would they do that? How could a person lose more than $1 million and yet still say, bugger that, I don't care about that, this guy's innocent? Why would they do that? They are the people that the public should be listening to, not all the people who never met Alan Hubbard. Here's the thing, Bernard Hickey stuck it to Alan Hubbard, never met him, never spoke to him. Martin Bradbury stuck it to Alan Hubbard, never met him, never spoke to him. Who do these people think they are? What gives them the sense of entitlement that says they can destroy the life of a fellow New Zealander, just destroy their reputation, destroy their dignity, strip them of everything with their rhetoric and their articles, and they don't even bother phoning the guy up and asking him his point of view? Mate, that's not journalism. At best, it's cowardice. At best, it's pure cowardice. At worst, it's Machiavellian.
I think at worst it's scumbaggery.
It's just pure scumbaggery. And Bradbury is simply helping Labor rewrite history and sweep this under the carpet, mate, with all this rhetoric. And I'm actually intensely angry with him for it, because I'll tell you the reason why I'm so angry with Martin Bradbury, even more than I'm angry with the likes of
Hickey and whatever.
All those guys. It's because of all people, he should know better. This guy holds himself out to be a social justice campaigner, and yet what he's effectively said with his article is, it doesn't matter if we dispense with Alan Hubbard's rights in this case because of the amount of money involved. Well, how can you be a social justice campaigner if you say, well, okay, above this dollar value, we don't give a shit about people? That's just... Sorry. Okay. The thing is that... You understand the point I'm trying to make?
Oh, yeah.
You can't have the situation where you can't have those kind of double standards playing out and hold yourself out to be a social justice campaigner. Bradbury needs to be more consistent in his approach on that, and I'll call him out on it. I'd forgive the guy if I saw him apologise for him. What he did was completely wrong and indefensible, given that the man was dead. He never had a trial. You can't stick it to a dead man who never had a trial. It's just wrong by anybody's standards, right? So that's my gripe with Martin Bradbury. I'll move on from that. Alan Hubbard's death, here's the facts that people should understand. The other driver came onto their side of the road, and the police have told Jean Hubbard, now this came from her own words to me in person, the police have told her that she was stopped at the time of impact. At the point of impact, she had already stopped. She was stopped in her lane heading south. The other guy had crossed over, had come towards them in their lane for quite some considerable distance, to the point where she saw him coming and braked and stopped. This guy hit them at over 100 kilometres. He started braking 10 metres before the impact. He hit... Bearing in mind they're in the southbound lane, Alan Hubbard's in the passenger seat, so he's on the left-hand side of the car, right? The other guy's coming northbound in the southbound lane on their side of the road and still hits Alan Hubbard's side of the car. So he would have been heading towards the grass verge or the ditch, right? This guy braked 10 metres before he hit them at full speed, because the skid marks are 10 metres or about 10 metres long, and he hit them at whatever speed you're still doing when you brake at 100 kilometres an hour. You skid for 10 metres, whatever speed you're still doing, he hit them at that speed and took out Alan Hubbard's side of the car. Right? Now, they were all taken to hospital in Oamaru. Alan Hubbard was alive for nearly 2 hours in the Oamaru emergency department, laughing and chatting with the nursing staff. He had been stabilised. He had a broken femur, that's a leg bone, a thigh bone. He had a fractured pelvis and a broken hip, by my understanding. His injuries were survivable. He had been stabilised. He was known to have been, there's a newspaper article that actually says, from a witness was there at the time and said he was laughing and joking with nursing staff in the Oamaru emergency department before he was airlifted by helicopter to Dunedin Hospital. Now, that flight was about 20 minutes long. He died in that helicopter. Alan Hubbard was not killed in a car accident. Alan Hubbard died while being transferred from Oamaru Hospital where he left. He was alive when he left Omaru Hospital. He was dead when he arrived in Dunedin 20 minutes later. Alan Hubbard died in the ambulance as a result of what? We don't know.
There was no autopsy?
Why? Now, here's this. There is an autopsy report, but it's been suppressed. 3 days after he died, that support was... the government sought to suppress Alan Hubbard's autopsy report, and that has occurred. Now, I know Alan Hubbard's doctor personally, their surgeon, right? He has read the autopsy report, and this is his exact words to me. He said, the family are not educated enough to understand what the implications contained in this report are. He said, but I am not satisfied with the autopsy report. He said, and this is his exact words to me, he said, the type of tests they ran on Alan's body were not the type of tests that would normally be run on a road accident victim. He said, I'm not satisfied with the autopsy report. He said, it's inconclusive. And he said, it suggests to me that they were either deliberately or accidentally looking for the wrong things. Okay? So that's from his doctor. Okay? Now, you know, what I don't know whether he was given a blood transfusion in the helicopter or not, but what I do know, again from the same doctor, is that John Key apparently had Dunedin Hospital put under lockdown when that helicopter arrived and the announcement made that Alan Hubbard was dead. That night, the Friday night, John Key had the whole of Dunedin Hospital put under lockdown. Now, why was that the case? Why did the Prime Minister, if that is true, and I don't know if it was, but if it was true, why was the Prime Minister interfering in that matter? What possessed John Key to interfere in that matter? Right, for a start, people should be asking these kind of questions. Secondly, why has the autopsy report been suppressed? Why? Why can't we see it? Right? Thirdly, why has the other driver... We're now in what? Where are we? March 2013. The accident occurred in September 2011. The other driver still hasn't gone to trial yet. He was allowed to walk into court three times last year in 2012 and seek an adjournment of his trial and was granted it. No questions asked. How did that happen? How has this guy got away without actually ever going to trial? And more importantly, when he was on their side of the road and hit them head on, how does he get away with pleading not guilty? I mean, he's entitled to, but how can he plead, realistically, not guilty? I mean, what planet does this guy live on? He was on their side of the road. It's just, this whole thing's disturbing. And here's another factor that a lot of people don't realise. 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed, right, and I use that word, that term very carefully, he wasn't killed in a car accident, but I still say he was killed on that day, right? 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed, his court case that he was taking against the government to challenge their actions against him, much in the same way Kim.com has, was due to start. Alan Hubbard's case against the government that he took to challenge their actions against him was due to start 3 days after that accident on the day he was killed.
Mm. And this accident also happened on a straight road.
A straight piece of road. It goes for 2 kilometres, dead straight. Now, I know the evidence because I was on the phone with Alan the night before he was killed. That's why I know that on the day after he was killed, he was due to fly to Nelson. What had happened was the day after he was killed, him and Gene were due to fly to Nelson to attend the ceremony. A ceremony where Helicopters New Zealand was being handed to the new Canadian owners, the Canadian helicopter company that bought it. They had requested that Alan Hubbard come to that handover ceremony out of respect for the fact that he had built that company, that he pioneered the rescue helicopter service in New Zealand, that he pioneered the helicopter industry in New Zealand. They wanted to show recognition for that by inviting Alan and Jean to Nelson. So I know for a fact they were due to fly to Nelson to be with their daughter to attend the handover ceremony of this company that he had effectively given away to the New Zealand public, right, as part of the South Canterbury Finance thing, which he was never acknowledged for. Now, that was due to happen the day after he died. So So this is how much I know. And I was on the phone with Alan the night before he died. He was telling me in the 2 weeks before that case was due to start, he'd started to tell me what evidence was going to be before it put in the courtroom. So I know how incriminating it was going to be for John Key. I was rubbing my hands together and waiting for it, bearing in mind this was 5 weeks before the election. Right? So what would have happened if Alan Hubbard had survived and gone to court and tabled the documents that his lawyers had against the government, questioning the government's actions against Alan Hubbard? What would have happened if the evidence that Alan Hubbard had against John Key and the government was going to be tabled in court? Because I'll tell you what the first piece of evidence was going to be. Alan Hubbard's lawyers were going to walk into a court 3 days after he was killed, and they were going to put down the videotape of John Key on the steps of Parliament influencing public opinion against Alan Hubbard while the matter was still under investigation. That was one of the first pieces of evidence that was going to be used against the government because it was indefensible. John Key cannot now, unlike Kim.com, where he's got the protection of saying, oh, well, I was advised, my officials didn't tell me this, and I only saw a photograph on an iPad somewhere briefly, right? He's got plausible deniability. He had no plausible deniability in Alan Hubbard's case because there he is on the steps of Parliament on national television, flat out influencing public opinion on the issue. So the Prime Minister has perverted the course of justice and nobody's questioned it. That was going to be questioned in the court case that was due to start 3 days after Alan Hubbard was killed. And John Key would have had to answer for that, and that was 5 weeks before the election. Now, how the hell was John Key going to wriggle out of that situation? And more importantly, why haven't the media questioned it? Why did nobody in the media provide a conscience on that issue and go out with an article saying, why is the Prime Minister influencing public opinion on an issue that's still under investigation? How is this happening?
I can offer one answer for that. I did interview a mainstream media journalist from Fairfax Media, and he said, I refuse to ask really tough questions of these big politicians that I interview, because if I start asking tough questions, I'll never be accepted for an interview again.
Yeah. Right? So here's the thing. What John Key did was utterly legally indefensible. There is no way that Alan Hubbard could easily have argued that the Prime Minister not only perverted the course of justice, but effectively cost the government the Crown's case against Alan Hubbard by influencing public opinion on the matter while it was still under investigation. That evidence alone could have had the case thrown out. So here you had the government. You think about this, New Zealand. Here you've had the government had created this huge media trial against this man, all orchestrated, where more than half of New Zealand was, if not convinced, then certainly wondering whether Alan Hubbard was guilty or not, based on what John Key and all of his mates and all the media people and all the rhetoric had said, right? What if John Key had been caught pants down, red-handed, 5 weeks before the election, in a situation he couldn't wriggle out of, where there was this court case that he could not argue that he hadn't influenced public opinion on this issue? Because there it is in black and white. There it is in the TVNZ archives. The evidence is incontrovertible. He did that. He can't distance himself from it. Now, that was absolute flat-out perversion of the course of justice at the Prime Minister's own hands. He cannot get out of it. That could have easily cost the case, the Crown, the case against Alan Hubbard, and should have.
And not to mention lost the election.
Let me put it to you this way. If you were Alan Hubbard's lawyer, the first thing you would have done is walked into court and said, Your Honour, the Crown...
Oh, sorry, Paul, we've got to break now. We'll hold that thought. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Paul Carruthers from New Zealand investigating the instances around Alan Hubbard. You know, ladies and gentlemen, I bet you've never heard any of this before. Okay, you know why? It's been frickin' covered up, and we're uncovering it today. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Final segment here with Paul Carruthers. All right, so we wanted to finish off the discussion about the suspicious circumstances surrounding Alan's death, and of course any final closing statements as well. Paul, take it away.
Well, you know, I mean, we've covered a lot. I mean, at the end of the day, where we were up to when we closed off was the issue of the fact, the proximity of the court case that Alan was taking against the government to his death, or the proximity of his death to the court case he was taking. Now, the point is that the evidence that was going to be tabled in that court case would have found its way into the media very quickly, clearly, because it had been a very high-profile issue. It was 5 weeks before the election, and the evidence that was going to be tabled in court in Alan Hubbard's defence was extremely damaging for the government. Extremely damaging. Alan told me, I don't know if this is true or not, I've done an Official Information Act request and they've come back and played all secret squirrel, so I don't know if this part is true or not. They've said, oh, no, no such email exists, or we've got no record of that or anything. But Alan told me 2 weeks before he died that his lawyers, because when you're charged with a crime by the Crown, you're entitled to apply for the evidence they've got against you. Right, your lawyer can apply to the Crown for the evidence they've got against you, and they have to give it to you so you can prepare your defence. They received an email from Simon. Now, Alan told me himself that his lawyers were in possession of an email from Simon Power to Treasury that was dated and timed less than an hour before the decision, before Simon Power announced to the whole of New Zealand that Alan was being placed into statutory management and investigated for fraud. Alan told me on the telephone 2 weeks before he died that one of the pieces of evidence his lawyers were intending to use in that court case that was due to start just after he was killed was an email from Simon Power to Treasury timed less than an hour before the announcement was made by Simon Power on national television on June 20th, 2010. That said something to the effect of, or Alan's words were that the email said, can somebody please contact me and tell me what statutory management means so I know what I'm talking about. Now, this is from a Minister of the Crown who issued the order to do this to Alan Hubbard and I can produce you dozens and dozens and dozens of emails from Alan Hubbard's investors that were sent after the fact to Simon Power's office saying, why have you done this? This is disgusting. Simon Power, in every single case, replied back and said, and every single reply said, I gave this matter careful consideration.
Now, he was the Justice Minister, wasn't he?
Justice who resigned at the last election.
And then he became the head of Westpac Bank, which does the government's banking.
He became the head of Westpac Private Banking, and they were one of the principal beneficiaries of the South Canterbury Finance Receivership. So the conflicts, this situation is so riddled with conflicts, it's unbelievable. And New Zealanders need to get this. The only reason that John Key and everyone else involved in this has got away with it is because all of you are so mesmerised by the issue of finance companies and finance company directors. They're all so evil as far as you're concerned that you're happy to dispense with procedure, proper process and justice in any of these people cases as long as you're seeing the government hang them. And that is your fundamental mistake. You have effectively, by sitting there in silence and letting this happen, you have assisted John Key and his mates to rip you off. And look, I'll say this for the record now. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to be proven beyond any doubt that everything I've harped on about for the last 2 years is wrong. Nothing would give me greater pleasure than to be wrong about John Key. But all of the evidence I've seen, and I've been more involved in this than anyone else, right? I've been involved in this as much as Alan Hubbard's lawyers have. I can tell you now, there is no doubt, based on the evidence I've seen in my mind, that this has been a travesty of justice and that the New Zealand public have been defrauded and that they have not been defrauded by Alan Hubbard. They have been defrauded by everyone from John Key downwards in this situation who's been involved in it. Absolutely no doubt in my mind. And I'm more than happy to be proven wrong. But none of my critics have yet produced any evidence to suggest to prove me wrong. None. What they do is they make it all about my personality or I got angry or I'm all these reasons why no one should listen to me. But none of them ever actually argue with me on the issue. They attack my personality. they never argue the point. And the reason why? Because they can't. Because the government's actions have been indefensible, completely indefensible. None of it would stand up in a court of law, and it wouldn't have stood up in a court of law if Alan Hubbard had been allowed to go to court and actually proceed with the case against John Key and the government. But the fact that he was killed 3 days before he got the chance means that we've all got to take John Key's word for it. And, you know, his lawyers are sitting on all the information. I mean, they're still sending his wife bills, $5 million down the track. His lawyers have never issued one word in their client's defence. Not one. They've never issued. They allowed this entire media trial to play out, and not once did they do anything to stem it, stop it from happening, or challenge any of the people. Now, they can take a passive approach and say, well, Alan Hubbard never instructed us to sue them. Well, maybe so. But they still allowed this complete media trial to play out, the complete destruction of their compliance, their clients' reputation, livelihood, businesses, assets, everything, the total destruction. They let it all happen, and not once did they issue any statement in their client's defence or take any action that was designed to stop it.
If I may, is the only thing they've issued more bills for their fees for work they haven't done?
Absolutely. I was saying to Alan long before he was even killed, get rid of your lawyers. He was certainly considering it, but he got to the point where the thing was so complex and entrenched by that stage, he was worried that if he did that, it would make him look guilty. So it ended up in an impossible situation for the guy. Just impossible. Just impossible. And now we find out that the two lawyers that were appointed to defend him, Tim Clark was defending him on the statutory management issue, and Michael Heron was defending him on the fraud issue. Tim Clark's been proven in that list that Lockwood Smith, the former speaker of the top 15 people with most influence of Parliament, Tim Clark's number two on the list. And at the end of last year, we see a little newspaper article, Mike Heron's accepted the job of Solicitor General. So the government sticks it to Alan Hubbard, and then they offer a job to one of his lawyers after the guy's dead, where they've appointed him as Solicitor General. So the guy's never going to give any evidence against. The guy's got the evidence to prove that what they did to Alan Hubbard was unlawful, and he's now working for Alan Hubbard's accusers. So Alan Hubbard just doesn't stand a chance. And yet, in the middle of all of this, while this was carrying on, a girl leaves her job with the Ministry of Economic Development and the National Enforcement Unit. She leaves her job. She's so distressed by what she's seeing happening that she goes to Alan Hubbard's house and offers to do an investigation for him. This woman worked for the British Securities Exchange Commission. She's arrested people on international arrest warrants for money laundering. She's a private investigator. She's highly qualified. She was a police person. She was a policewoman in New Zealand for 8 years. Very qualified woman. She was so distressed by what the government was doing, she quit her job and she voluntarily wrote Alan Hubbard a report of the government's actions that proved beyond any doubt that the government's actions were unlawful in Alan Hubbard's case, and his lawyers dismissed it.
You know what? It sounds like a massive, massive bunch of criminals saw a massive juicy pot and an easy target. I mean, it's like, look at this. You see a bank that doesn't have a vault, a huge quantity of money inside there, and you are friends with the guards, you're friends with the bank tellers, you're friends with the people who watch all the security videos, and you think, you know what? There's nothing to stop us. Let's just steal it.
My closing statement, Vinny, New Zealand, you have been absolutely had, and not by Alan Hubbard, right? And if you don't question this, then you deserve to lose the $1.5 billion that you've just been ripped off for. But if any one of you ever tries to tell me that it was Alan Hubbard's fault, you better know your facts, because I'll walk all over you with them.
And they also, I wanted to add to that as well, if you let this happen to Alan Hubbard, ladies and gentlemen of New Zealand, it can happen to you, it can happen to anybody.
That's my point all along.
Mm-hmm. Who are you going to trust if the people that you are elected to protect your rights and your country are in fact the ones destroying your rights and destroying your country?
You are being had. You are being taken for a ride, and you're all falling for it. Question this. Question it. Question what happened to Alan Hubbard. Demand answers, and you watch this government run out of corners to hide in 10 seconds flat. demand an inquiry into what happened here and watch the excuses come out. That should be all the proof you need that I'm right.
Yeah. It's an overarching extra episode of Ghostbusters. Who are you going to call?
All right, mate. Been good talking to you, Vinny.
It has been. All right. Well, we've discussed pretty much everything we can. If you're not willing to listen to this, it's already too late for you, I'm afraid. And if you're not willing to do the right thing, heaven help you. I feel very angry. I feel betrayed. And the fact that I'm the only one in this whole freaking country of 4 million people to give somebody like Paul a platform to tell the truth and the whole truth about this situation doesn't make me proud that I'm the only one doing it. It makes me ashamed that I'm the only one doing it. Ashamed of my country. Ashamed of my people. What's your excuse? What's your excuse? You know? What are you people thinking and playing at? You think this is a good thing? You think that trialing people with no evidence doctored is a free and open and honest society that isn't going to somehow collapse into a massive tyranny where the scumbaggery individuals that rule the country currently ain't just going to get worse and worse and worse and do whatever they want with any of us for no frickin' reason just because they want to steal something from you? What do you think this is going to lead to, ladies and gentlemen? Get off your ass. Do something. Get angry. And don't take no for an answer. I'm Vinny Eastwood, Mr. News, and this has been Paul Carruthers as well. Thank you very much for your attention, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry for getting angry. Hopefully they'll demonize my character and say that, oh, he's a bad person, you know, for that. You know, maybe he'll get something. Yeah. All right. We'll see you again sometime, ladies and gentlemen. Don't you go changing that channel.